Halo, serving the Oregon coast at 91.7 on your FM dial. Streaming live and archived, baby, at xray.fm. Radio is yours.
X-Ray FM supports our friends at the YMCA of Columbia Willamette, hosting Belonging Through Play, a series of summer camps providing kids with easy and safe opportunities for interacting with new kids and helping them build crucial friendships. Additional sports, enrichment, and full-day licensed camps are offered throughout the summer in the Portland-Vancouver area. Camp schedules and more information available at ymcacw.org/camps.
You're listening to Street Roots Radio on X-Ray FM. I'm Hannah Francis. Street Roots Radio is a collaboration between X-Ray FM, KB Radio, and local publication Street Roots. Street Roots is a nonprofit organization in Portland, Oregon that creates income opportunities for people experiencing homelessness and poverty by producing a newspaper and other media that are catalysts for individual and social change. Today, I have here with me Street Roots correspondent, as well as local writer and activist, Bruce Poinsett, about his recent piece with Street Roots called Juneteenth Around the State. Juneteenth organizers around Oregon are navigating federal attacks on DEI and a hostile racial climate, and they're still pushing forward. Thanks so much for being here with me, Bruce.
Yeah, thanks, Hannah, for having me.
Yeah, of course. So this is a really timely article. This article is being published on June 17th, which is 2 days before the national Juneteenth celebration. And, you know, I think that a lot of people are aware of what Juneteenth is by now, but can you tell me a little bit about that day?
Yeah, so Juneteenth commemorates the day when enslaved people in Galveston, Texas learned they were free a full 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. And just for clarification, the thing that, you know, actually freed enslaved people is the 13th Amendment. But yeah, so basically when the order was made when the order announcing that all enslaved people were free, and that news was delivered to the people in Galveston in 1865, that's basically like what Juneteenth commemorates. I think at the time it wasn't called Juneteenth. It was Jubilee Day. And yeah, so the first, I believe the first recorded known Juneteenth celebrations were in Texas led by Freedmen in 1866. So talking about a year later. And what's notable in these, the early days of Juneteenth, the early years, I should say, of Juneteenth, is that because of segregation, Black people were not allowed to, you know, use the public parks. So the way that organizers would get around that was to basically buy land so that they could, among other things, hold these events. And I think that's it's significant for a few reasons, but one that's kind of relevant, especially to today and everything that's happened with the Voting Rights Act, is that this was also used as a place to share instructions for voting amongst Black people, and often like rallies for political participation, as well as, you know, celebration and, again, literally like jubilee from freedom. But it's also, I think, to that point, it's something that's relevant because there's always a legacy of having to work around these systems to make these things happen, which, you know, persists to this day. And it's kind of the, really the basis of this article.
Right. So you also, I want to talk a little bit more about history there. There was like a period of time when these celebrations got really stifled out.
Yeah. So the celebrations, like I said, that 1866, it kind of like took off that early like Reconstruction era, but then around really like, you know, the implementation of Jim Crow, as well as just Black migration out of the South, they kind of died down. So some of that was just, you know, people moving from primarily farms to big cities and feeling like, you know, the need for assimilation just didn't make it as prominent or as important. And, or not even prominent as important, but just something that you didn't want to, you know, to give yourself the best chance out in the world, you wanted to, like I said, assimilate. And they didn't really come back into vogue, I guess might be the word, like that, until sort of like the 1960s and the civil rights era, when the celebrations were kind of tied to the movement and, you know, tied just like the affirmation of Black identity.
So the Trump administration, and we'll talk about later how like local administrations as well, have been kind of trying to like crack down on this federal holiday. Could you explain a little bit of what the Trump administration has been doing to block these celebrations?
Yeah, so legally, the Trump administration can't just basically say, we're no longer doing Juneteenth celebrations. Like, they were recognized through a vote from Congress, and in order to stop them, you'd need the same things, a vote from Congress, which is not in the cards right now anyway. That said, there's like, you know, little measures just to discourage, I guess, participation, or at least one of the most prominent examples is that on Juneteenth, I think after it was recognized as a federal holiday by the Biden administration in 2021, one of the things they did was just make entry into national parks free on that day, you know, as a recognizing as a federal holiday. So it raised awareness of Juneteenth and also encouraged people just in a very small way to learn about it, participate. So one of the things the Trump administration has done is basically take away that free entry at national parks. On a larger level, the Trump administration's kind of overarching attack on DEI has made a lot of, particularly like federal agencies, people who rely on, or organizations who rely on grants or federal grants, preemptively pull out of supporting these things. Basically, like they have a page on the White House website where they call DEI programs, which is diversity, equity, inclusion, illegal and immoral. And, you know, they just, again, like through the rhetoric of White House officials, and then through, like I said, policies like canceling free entry on national parks, they just basically like send out this message that, you know, you can be punished for celebrating things like Juneteenth, or in a larger sense, just, I guess, uplifting underserved groups, particularly people of color, Black and brown people, queer people. So, like I said, it's a two-pronged thing of anything they can actually do, like removing the park fees, but then also just the larger piece of sending that message where groups feel like they don't want to have their funding threatened, so they'll preemptively not support, or preemptively pull out, or preemptively, you know, remove the Black Lives Matter statements that they put on their websites and things to that degree. And that also plays out in some of these local celebrations, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
Yeah. Only 31 states out of 50 recognize this day as a paid holiday, right? And Oregon is one of them. But despite this, we're still seeing like a lot of barriers to these celebrations being supported and happening around our state. So we've got four different areas to sort of talk about today. And then
with this article, I covered four spaces. So Portland, Oregon City, Central Oregon, Southern Oregon. And obviously there's Juneteenth celebrations in other parts of Oregon, but I just wanted to kind of pick four places to kind of just give like some snapshots of different regions, different dynamics, but also the similarities, and just really emphasize this idea that Black Oregonians are everywhere and we're main characters in our stories everywhere. So with that said, when it comes to Portland, obviously like that's where, you know, there's a number of Juneteenth celebrations, and the longest running one, which is again Juneteenth Oregon Festival and Clara May Peoples Freedom Parade. So it's named after, you know, the namesake of the person who really led these, which is Clara May Peoples, who came to Portland and was working on the Kaiser shipyards, was surprised that, you know, her fellow workers didn't know about Juneteenth. So she basically kind of brought the celebration to them. And this was about 1945. And she was also just like a prolific community advocate, you know, supporter. One of the people I talked to, Heather Coleman Cox, who's an organizer with the Juneteenth Festival and Clara People's Freedom Parade today, you know, actually, like, she and her siblings used to get food from Clara May Peoples, who, you know, served people in need in the community back when she was a child in like the 70s. But anyways, so it was kind of like an informal celebration in those like early decades. And then I think 1972, it was Peoples made a push to really get it recognized, and that was the first year where it was a city recognized celebration. So now it is entering its, you know, its 54th anniversary, and it's the largest, you know, Juneteenth celebration in the state. It has, you know, myriad sponsors. You know, it just produces a number of like great images and photos because you have all these performances. A lot of people turn out. The parade is obviously large, well attended. It has huge cross section of the city, and yeah, Peoples passed in 2015. You know, they've really, I would say, like, really, especially since then, really worked to not just like expand the celebration, because I think for a lot of years it was known, like I said, city recognized, but even like the organizers, you know, would tell you that it didn't really pick up and get to this larger scale till around 2020 and just like, you know, the racial reckoning of that time. But like I said, I talked with Heather Coleman Cox, who's one of the organizers, and she works with people's daughter and granddaughters. And, you know, their thing is really like expanding the legacy and really trying to like see out people's vision. So as big as it is right now, one of the things that Coleman Cox talked about was wanting to see it in a similar place where you see like Pride and Cinco de Mayo, specifically with like a big celebration on the waterfront. That was something Peoples wanted, obviously did not get to see in her lifetime. But that's kind of juxtaposed right now with like anyone, they're dealing with cuts. They're dealing with sponsors who can no longer provide either like financial or any sponsorship, or have to, as she put it, find creative ways to support because of fear of cuts to federal funding.
Along with that conversation, there's like some dialogue in your piece about how like there's a debate around there being like too many Juneteenth celebrations in Oregon relative to the size of the Black population, which is obviously just ridiculous. But you have some really strong quotes from Heather Coleman Cox on this specifically. Would you mind sharing some of what she had to say about that?
Yeah. So there's always this recurring kind of conversation, quote unquote, debate of like, do we have too many Juneteenth celebrations in Oregon? Wouldn't it be better if we like centralized around one so that, you know, it would be better attended? And, you know, I talked earlier about wanting to expand the Juneteenth Oregon Festival and Clara May Peoples Freedom Parade to, you know, the waterfront. And so wouldn't, you know, idea of like centralizing Juneteenth celebrations contribute to that? And I think Coleman Cox, as well as others, kind of expressed the point that think about how many 4th of July celebrations there are. No one's saying we should just have one. You have, you know, picnics, barbecues, all kinds of different things all over every city, multiple, you know, big celebrations in cities. So why do we think so small with Juneteenth? And I think this what makes it more important is, like I said earlier, like Black Oregonians are everywhere. It's not, if you're living in Bend, for example, if you're living in Hood River, should you have to drive all the way into Portland if you want to celebrate Juneteenth? If you're in Ashland, should you have to make this 5-hour drive to recognize Juneteenth because that's where most of the Black population is? That doesn't make sense. And clearly, based on these celebrations, and we'll get into like size and, you know, what they look like in other places in a little bit, but it just doesn't, we don't need to think that small. We don't need to think from such a like starvation mindset when it comes to Juneteenth. And also, it's not just a Black holiday. It's a celebration of freedom. And, you know, it's basically as Coleman Cox put it, it's an American celebration.
Yeah, well said. Talking about, you know, other celebrations happening around Oregon, let's talk about Oregon City. Tori Blackwell is one of the people you mentioned as being a main component of the celebrations there. They've been the Oregon City Juneteenth planning team since its inception in 2020, and also leads Unite Oregon City.
Yeah, so Tori is, a real just a community champion, and I don't know if I can call him an unsung hero anymore, but still someone who plays a lot of roles in just general like equity work in Oregon City, including Unite Oregon City and a grassroots organization and the Juneteenth planning, as well as LEDIC in Clackamas County. But I think what was really valuable in talking with him about not just like how it's evolved, but where it's going, is that he's really, really good on talking about the how. So he knows that's been largely just like a volunteer effort since 2020 to get these going. And it's also been very much the result of strategic partnerships because, yeah, it can be an all-volunteer effort, but if you want to make a celebration to really bring out families, especially in a place like Oregon City that doesn't have a particularly great reputation for, you know, being welcoming to Black people, then you have to put some more investment in there. You want to get performers, you want to get food vendors, and you don't want to create basically a barrier by saying, yeah, you can vend, you can perform in Oregon City, but you have to do it for free. Like, that's just not, it's not equitable. And why would you say, like, come to this place that you might, if you've never been there, or even if you've been there, going to a place of possible hostility and doing it under the guise of free labor is just not equitable. So they've had to use strategic partnerships, like saying, okay, let's work with the library, let's work with Parks and Rec, let's find agencies or departments where there's existing funding, and, you know, we can basically get what we need to make the celebration what it can be and really attract families, especially, you know, again, I said, like, it's not a Black celebration, it's an American celebration, but you do want to bring out, especially like Black community in Oregon City, Clackamas County, and encourage people to attend these things. So doing what you need to invest in it. And more recently, they've been working with the End of the Oregon Trail Interpretive Center, which, again, has another mandate to provide accurate history. So, you know, finding that alignment between them and a Juneteenth celebration, just to find resources, whether it's funding, but also space to do these celebrations. So, you know, like I said, it's largely volunteer effort. It's a creative effort. And, you know, right now in Clackamas County is a place that, you know, there has been a lot of hostility to, yeah, not just Black celebrations, Black life, but in DEI, equity in general, especially in these last several years. So, yeah, like I said, it's just a combination of creativity and will, and having people like Tori and Heidi Blackwell, people like that in the community who are just really determined to make sure these things happen, and which is also kind of a theme in this, because I also interviewed Denise McGriff, who's the mayor of Oregon City, Oregon City's first Black mayor and one of three Black mayors in Oregon. And, you know, one of the worries that comes with these Oregon City Juneteenth celebrations is, okay, what happens if some of these community champions, some of these engines are just not there? Like, her term is coming to an end in, I believe, 6 months. Also, another champion that they've named, Greg Williams, who is the library director, he's leaving this month as well. What is it going to look like to, you know, get these celebrations across the finish line? What is it going to look like to make sure they have the resources they need and are operated not just equitably, but also well, and that make them inviting and fun and continue to grow them? Like, what is it going to look like to do that when maybe you don't have these people in these positions that they've been in the past? And it's just, it's very tenuous.
Yeah. And you also mentioned, you know, like the absence of Diwali, Chinese New Year, and Cinco de Mayo in Oregon City in 2026, and the concern of just like the general trend of that.
So I think, yeah, Mayor McGriff noted that, yeah, they're not doing Cinco de Mayo, Diwali, and Chinese New Year in 2026, in part because like the grassroots groups and kind of like those community champions who would really led the organizing for that, just they didn't apply for grants this year. And I think that just really spells out that these worries about the tenuousness of Juneteenth celebrations are not theoretical. There are examples right now of that happening. So I just want to really highlight that point. And also another thing that Tori Blackwell notes when it comes to the security or lack thereof when it comes to Juneteenth celebrations is that they're not a budget line item. Really highlights that point, like when I was able to speak with them, that it's different when it's a thing that, you know, you do and it's folded into something else, but it can easily be taken away, versus when you make it a priority and you say, no, this is a line item in our city budget. That's just one show of making it official and saying we're invested in this no matter who's here, versus we're invested in this because we just happen to have these people in decision-making positions right now.
You mentioned that some of the organizers, the Central Oregon Earthseeds, are not partnering with the city of Bend for their 2026 celebration. They're like kind of excited to be taking this in their own hands and to be crowdfunding for this. But at the same time, it's like it's not being organized by the city. And so it's, you know, there's some positives and negatives there. Will you tell me more about that decision and like also some of the like controversy around funding based on like a Facebook post?
Yeah. So the first Central Oregon Juneteenth celebration was in 2020. And I spoke with Jocelyn Stanfield, who's an organizer with Central Oregon Earthseeds. And that first one was an all grassroots event, you know, just a picnic, relatively small. And, you know, as things grew, they partnered with another group that does grassroots organizing and serving Black communities down there, specifically in Bend, the Fathers Group. Stanfield's actually from Prineville. But yeah, so the basis was grassroots, but then it kind of grew. It became between 2021 and 2024, or no, I'm sorry, between 2020 and 2024, it was held at Drake Park. And as it grew, it got more, you know, buy-in and support and partnership, including with the city of Bend. But then in last year, to get to your question about the controversy, so Stanfield had posted on Facebook, basically she posted, if you as a white person have ever fixed your mouth to disrespect the black women who got the ball rolling in Central Oregon, you are not invited to a celebration meant to uplift us. So the other thing I should say about Central Oregon Earthseeds and the organizers of that first Juneteenth celebration is this is an organization of black women in Central Oregon who, again, just volunteered, were determined to make this more prominent and put it on. So Stanfield is just saying, hey, if you don't respect black women, you don't respect the black women who put this on, you're not invited to the celebration.
I'd say that makes sense.
Yeah, it seems pretty straightforward. However, complaints were made to the city of Bend, and the interpretation was basically white people are not invited, which that doesn't say, but also it became the subject of, you know, news coverage, special city meetings, and this whole process where the funding was delayed until, I'd say, maybe like a month or so before the celebration. And even though they finally, you know, went through with it, it just from talking with Stanfield, it left a really bad taste in her and I imagine other organizers' mouths. Because, you know, if it's that easy to disrupt and possibly just take down the Juneteenth celebration, and if there's a certain feeling of powerlessness you have when you're depending on funding from the city and you're being caught up in controversy over, again, saying people who disrespect the organizers are not invited to a celebration. When you fast forward to this year in 2026, yeah, I can understand why she would say it's actually a plus not to have or not to be in partnership with the city of Bend on this, because it gives you more control and they still have the partnerships with other grassroots organizations in the city.
Is there anything else that you'd like to say about what you've kind of witnessed as the organizing scene in Central Oregon as a whole being?
Yeah. Other person I interviewed, Marcus LeGrand, he's a founding member of the Fathers Group, which basically led the Juneteenth celebrations between 2021 and 2024. And Fathers Group is based in Bend. It's a group of black fathers serving black community in a variety of ways. But man, Marcus LeGrand, in addition to being a member of the Fathers Group, he's also part of the faculty at Central Oregon Community College, and he's a Bend Lapine School District board member. So, you know, he's heavily involved in the community. And one of the things he really emphasizes is just like the climate, specifically when it comes to anti-blackness in Bend. I think on a general level, there's just kind of a lot of things that come with honestly anti-blackness throughout Oregon in terms of just being isolated in general, but then also a lot of ignorance you deal with on a daily basis in terms of like what people say to you. And I'm not even saying just like the N-word and stuff like that, but, you know, just all kinds of people dealing with you in stereotypes and, you know, being profiled, whether it be by police, but then also, you know, underestimated, judged, really just treated inequitably by people. However, you know, not very long ago, I believe 2021, there was also a very high profile killing of Barry Washington Jr., who was a black 21-year-old by Ian Cranston outside a Bend nightclub. So previously Cranston had been convicted of, I believe, manslaughter, and, you know, he was serving a 10-year sentence. But earlier this year, that conviction was actually overturned upon appeal, and it's going to be basically retried. And Cranston's currently has been released, so he's currently out. So in addition to just the general climate, which was part of what started the Fathers Group, there's also this very high-profile case of the killing of a young black man. And it's just like, it's in the air, it's in the atmosphere. So LeGrand kind of talked about just the obligation he feels as an educator, trying to instill in students to be able to keep their heads up, to continue to not shy away. This urge, I guess, to really shrink yourself, especially when you feel like that hostility throughout a community and that atmosphere. So that work has been even more difficult, whether it's at Central Oregon Community College, whether it's with the Fathers Group, whether it's just in the community in general. So one of the reasons I wanted to include that in this piece is also because, you know, often things, especially around anti-Blackness, but in particular in racism in general, they can be framed as like, oh, well, that's just something of the past. You know, Oregon exclusion laws, that was the 1800s. And we don't talk about how the legacy of these things persists to this day. And we don't talk about how, again, like just it affects people's everyday lives. And even when we do, sometimes that's dismissed and that's papered over. But kind of as we learned in, again, that 2020 racial reckoning and a country collectively, you know, watching the George Floyd murder video, that when you have these extremely unfortunate, horrific, high profile killings, like that's just something you can't turn away from. And anyone who's trying to deny that this is not a problem in Bend, Central Oregon, all throughout Oregon, is just like, that's just the example of look no further. So with these celebrations, it's a very small thing, relatively speaking, but even just providing space for people to engage with their history, to come together, to be with each other, to see other Black organizers who are standing strong, that means a lot, you know, in the climate of isolation and anti-Black hostility.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's what you're talking about kind of reminds me of what's in the Southern Oregon section base. The Black Alliance and Social Empowerment Organization is the organization that's putting on a Juneteenth celebration.
So Juneteenth was like the first kind of community celebration they did.
Right.
Basically, Vance Beach, the founder, and I said other organizers, and Vance is also originally from Arizona. So it's actually an organization he brought with him. He went to Southern Oregon University after he graduated, decided to stay down in Ashland. And, you know, they just wanted to basically serve Black families down there. So they have a variety of programs, you know, it's like community advocacy, you know, in like different government spaces, but also like they have a youth program, the Afro Scouts, specifically just for like, you know, activities for Black children down there. And they also work in the advocacy space, organizing and co-organizing demonstrations, rallies, vigils, and community celebrations. So their first, the first community event they did was in 2020. And yeah, it was a Juneteenth celebration. Just a community, you know, again, relatively small community celebration in Ashland. But their work, again, has expanded. And like I said, they do a lot of things. So in 2020, when Aiden Ellison, who was a 19-year-old Black former student at Ashland High School, when he was killed by Robert Keegan, who was a white man, after an altercation over loud music, they work with organizers down there to raise awareness about the case, but also, you know, honor the memory of Aiden Ellison. And they've always, even though they work, you know, with agencies, they have like working with police down there, they've also never kind of shied away from these tragedies and the harm that's being done to the community. So part of a group of organizers and organizations, you know, maintaining a memorial for Ellison that was continuously being defaced, they also lent their support to amplifying the Justice for Akeem campaign, which is an effort to exonerate Brian Akeem Simpson, who was a Black, Indigenous, and partially blind California firefighter who was convicted in 2024 of second-degree assault following an altercation with a fellow white firefighter, Brandon Olson. And according to witnesses, Olson was intoxicated, used racial slurs, and threw the first punch. A lot of these efforts has been led by the Oregon Remembrance Project, and BASE has been working with them, being, you know, in the region, as well as working with like the area chapters, and particularly like the Grants Pass chapter of the Oregon Remembrance Project, to raise awareness of this case, rally support, whether it's, you know, signing petitions, holding rallies, keeping people just aware of the latest updates, the latest legal updates with the case. And again, part of the reason for just like highlighting this is that the narrative around Basin, rightfully so, is a very positive one. And they do a lot of stuff that is not connected to tragedy and harm. But despite sometimes what gets lost in that framing is like the atmosphere they're operating in spaces where, you know, these are, you know, historic sundown towns. We actually just, for our personal platform, I operate Black Oregon POV. I actually just went down with the Oregon Remembrance Project to Ashland to on their first inaugural Sunshine Trip, which is literally a project taking Black Portland area organizers down to, you know, these Southern Oregon historic sundown towns to engage with the organizers down there, learn about the community, and just kind of build these bonds, work with each other, show the value in not just engaging with this history, not just learning about it, but doing real work to reckon with that history. Base, their main Juneteenth celebration that they organize is in Medford, but they also assist with celebrations in Grants Pass and Ashland. And the celebration in Medford, literally, like, it draws thousands. They have dozens of vendors, about half of whom or half or so are actually Black-owned businesses. And it's something that surprises a lot of people because, again, when you're in this Portland area and you think of Southern Oregon, chances are you don't think of Black people, much less that one of the biggest celebrations in the state is actually down there. And in addition to that, in addition to the Base and, you know, other groups, other organizers in that region, there's really a lot of exciting things happening. For example, in Grants Pass, it was one of the seven cities selected to be part of Opal Lee's Walk for Freedom activation. And for those who don't know, Opal Lee is considered the grandmother of Juneteenth. And, you know, in the mid 2010s, like, she had spent decades, you know, advocating for Juneteenth to become a federal holiday, but she was also known in her community for just doing these 2.5 mile walks to represent the 2.5 years until enslaved people in Galveston learned they were free. And she decided to do a symbolic walk from Fort Worth, Texas to Washington, D.C. in 2016. At the time, she was 89 years old. She's since passed, but yeah, like I said, there's a national activation that still celebrates the Opal Lee Walk for Freedom, and Grants Pass was one of the seven cities that was selected. And Opal Lee's daughter is actually going to be a special guest for that activation. So yeah, there's just like exciting things happening down in Southern Oregon. And for the people who think there's no Black people down there, not just are they down there, but they're doing really big things serving the community. And I just think it's really inspiring, and more people need to know about that.
Amazing. Thank you. Thanks for sharing that. So where can folks read this article and get these details about the different Juneteenth celebrations and see more about what you're doing?
So first off, with the article, it'll be coming out in the June 17th edition of Street Roots. So you can find it from your local Street Roots vendor if you want to find the, you know, hard copy. Find it, obviously, like streetroots.org. As far as the organizations, definitely, you know, look up the Juneteenth Oregon Festival. Look at the Juneteenth Oregon Festival in Clara, May People's Freedom Parade. As far as Oregon City, a good place to do that is looking up Unite Oregon City or the City of Oregon City's website. They've got all the information on this year's Juneteenth celebration. With Central Oregon, best thing to do is look up Central Oregon Earth Seeds Juneteenth, and you can find more information about that. And then with Base, I just say to look up Base Southern Oregon. They have all the information as well as a bunch of photos from past year's celebrations and info of like where to go, how to get involved. For me, I run a program, Black Oregon POV, and where you can find that right now is youtube.com/Black Oregon POV, or just search it on YouTube. as well as on Instagram. It's instagram.com/blackoregonPOV, all one word, both platforms. And the idea behind this is very simply, like, Black Oregonians are everywhere and we are main characters in the story. So
incredible. Thank you so much for sharing your time, Bruce. It's been lovely talking with you.
Yes. Thanks again, Hannah, for having me on.
You are listening to Street Roots Radio on X-Ray FM. I'm Hannah Francis.
Support for X-Ray FM comes from North Coast Pinball, Nehalem's Little Pinball Sanctuary, located on Highway 101 next to North Coast Mudworks. North Coast Pinball offers monthly tournaments and a selection of games from the 1970s to the present. Learn more at northcoastpinball.com.
It is official. Phil Neville is out as head coach of the Portland Timbers. After 2.5 seasons in charge, Neville and the Timbers organization have mutually agreed to part ways, closing the book on a tenure that began with so much hope but never fully found its footing. KXRW and X-Ray FM were at Providence Park for what would become Neville's final match on the Timbers sidelines, a loss to the San Jose Earthquakes. We take a look back on Neville's tenure, his final game, and what's next for the Timbers. When Neville came into Portland in November of 2023, he was already a well-established name in football. Before coaching, he spent nearly two decades as a player in the Premier League, most notably with Manchester United, where he came through during one of the club's most successful eras, as well as Everton and England's national team. As a coach, Neville's resume included leading the England's women's national team, a stint with Inter Miami, and assistant work with Canada's men's national team. However, Neville's hiring was not without controversy. Some Timbers supporters questioned the move from the beginning, both because of Neville's coaching record and also because of past social media comments that resurfaced when he was hired. Through it all, the club stood by Neville, and in his first season, Portland returned to the MLS playoffs in 2024, its first postseason appearance since hosting the MLS Cup in 2021. But the return warranted a quick one-and-done exit after a 5-0 wildcard round loss to Vancouver. Even with the quick playoff exit, there was still some hope around Timbers Army that Neville's first season could be a starting point. And in 2025, Portland did take a step forward as Neville led the Timbers back to the postseason for a second straight year, this time getting past the wildcard round with the club's first playoff victory since 2021. After two straight postseason appearances, the stage was set for 2026 to become Neville's proving ground, the year Portland needed to show it was no longer just hovering around the playoff line, but actually building towards something more. With all eyes on Neville, Portland opened 2026 with a victory, but from there, the momentum faded quickly. As the wins became harder to find, the same questions around consistency returned, and Portland found themselves near the bottom of the Western Conference at 4 wins, 7 losses, and 2 draws going into their final game before the World Cup break against San Jose at home. Facing the Quakes, the Timbers gave up 3 goals in the first half, including one in just the second minute. Neville emerged from halftime visibly irritated, and the scoreline stayed 3-1 until the final whistle. KXRW and X-Ray were in the media room after the game to hear Neville's thoughts on where the club stood after sinking to 4-8-2 before the World Cup, as he had to balance frustration and accountability.
You know, when you start in life, or the foundations of life is to compete. And if you don't compete, you can't win anything in life. And I think I've got an incredible bunch of talented players. But if talented players aren't willing to do the jobs that San Jose play, San Jose was a brilliant example. We've told them all week about what that team is about, is why they've got the points they've got, is because they do the things that really matter to win games of football. We've not done those things, and it's why we are in the table. It's why we've only got 14 points. I think it's totally unacceptable. Was the periods in the game where we could have scored? Yes. Was the periods in the game where we played some incredible football? Yes. But it actually, sorry for the language, it actually means jack it really. I think that's a big reflection of the 14 games, and you've got to take responsibility. I take responsibility and accountability, and we move forward.
By the 80th minute of the match, members of the Timbers Army began chanting "Fire Neville," while signs calling for his dismissal appeared in the stands. Neville was asked about hearing those chants and seeing that frustration from supporters.
It's what we sign up for. You know, I'm not, there's no pity party for me. Them supporters deserve better than what we've given them in the first 14 games. I think if I was in that Timbers army, I'd be doing the same. I'd want more from my team. The team that I support, the team that I love, the team that I'm passionate about, you know, the reason why we probably work hard all week is to pay for that ticket at the end of the week to come and watch the Portland Timbers play. We've got to take responsibility for it. I signed up as a manager, as a player, and that comes with it. The support that we've had at this football club is the reason why I'm here. The reason why those players love playing at home, and you respect everything that they do.
As Neville left the media room, the silence lingered, which was followed by a long, heavy sigh that seemed to say as much as anything he had just said at the podium and captured the weight of where things stood. Just 2 days later, on Monday, May 25th, it was announced that both the Timbers and Neville had mutually agreed to part ways. Portland will now be looking for a new head coach, and Neville's future, while uncertain, still holds promise. To our experience and understanding, even as the results fell short and such a rocky start, Neville carried himself with respect towards those around him and appeared to be respected by many inside the club. Reporting on the Portland Timbers for KXRW and X-Ray FM, I am Michael Sarno.
X-Ray is thrilled to announce that we are officially moving to a new home in Southeast Portland. In partnership with Kickstand Comedy, X-Ray's new headquarters will be at the corner of Southeast 10th and Hawthorne beginning this fall. Our transition to this new location will enable X-Ray to make better radio and engage with the public in a new accessible arts and civics hub, where we will host a broad array of events and gatherings. Go to xray.fm to learn more about the move and how you can help.
Use your heart, the more it aches. back. That's alright, babe, we all do that. Just wander out in the deep gun.
Hey there, it's me, Cosmic Grifter. Care to enter the psychedelic musical realm? Tune into my show, Growing Gently Insane, on X-Ray FM every Tuesday from midnight to 1. Not a night owl? Not a problem. Past shows are